Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its newest inductees. They are Nina Simone, the Moody Blues, Dire Straits, Bon Jovi, and the Cars. A couple of years ago, we spoke with Cars frontman Rick Ocasek. He's pretty much rock royalty here in Boston, and he's one of the most unassuming people I have ever interviewed. Really. And here's why. Throughout our interview, I'd been pronouncing his name Rick Ocasek. And when we wrapped up, I asked him to say his name and title just so we were sure to have that on tape. It's pretty much standard operating procedure at the end of recorded interviews. Now, remember, I'd been pronouncing his name Rick Ocasek during the conversation. So just listen to what he said.
Hi, this is Rick Ocasek, and I'm from the Cars.
Okay, first and foremost, I have to say you're such a gentleman because you didn't tell me that I've been pronouncing your last name wrong.
Oh, no, it's okay.
No, it's not okay. I'm so sorry.
No, people pronounce it a lot of different ways, and I care less how they pronounce it. And, you know, it's subjective as well because I have relatives who go, Ocasek. Ocasek. You know, there's a lot of different ways I guess people could say it. It is a weird spelling.
Well, you've been so cool
about
it.
It's not really wrong or right. I mean, I think my family says Ocasek, so that's the way I say it.
I'm going to go back and reintroduce you and get it right now. But Rick Ocasek, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Well, when we talked with Rick Ocasek back in 2013, he had just released a new book called Lyrics and Prose. And I started by asking him to walk us down memory lane. Let's go! I'd love to hear from you. Why is it that you did, back in 1972, decide to come to Boston?
Ben and I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. We had a band called Leatherwood. And oddly enough, we used to open for Iggy Pop and the MC5. Now we had to kind of a band that kind of wrecked your equipment. Thanks, thought we were, you know, pretty kind of hard stuff. But anyway, when it was time to get rid of or move, we sort of ran out of money and pawned over our equipment. And all I had left was an acoustic, and I thought that I knew that Cambridge was a good place to come with an acoustic guitar because I'd heard that you can play at Club 47 and you could play at, Passiums and all those places if you had an acoustic guitar. So we ventured to Boston in 1972, or probably 71 or 2. Arrived in Harvard Square and heard the Modern Lovers playing on the Common. And I thought, this is the place for me. The Modern Lovers are here. It's unbelievable. So we just kind of played on our own for a while, just Ben and I, acoustically. Yeah. And we managed to just scrape by while we were there. But we loved the city, so.
Well,
that's how we got there.
There's a story which I'm dying to know if it's true or not, but I've read that in 74, you and Ben Orr were playing as a duo at a Boston Ground Round restaurant on the South Shore, and you guys were playing until a vice president or a manager stopped you one night, he stopped in one night of the company, and he said you couldn't play anymore because you weren't family-friendly entertainment. Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
Yep, what were you singing?
It is true.
What were you singing?
I don't know. We were just we were always playing, even when we played those places in Boston in the beginning. We told people that we played top 40 stuff so we could get the gig. But then when we went there, we never played any of that. We just played my own songs. Some people thought they were top 40, and they just missed it. That was probably the reason. We kind of got fired from a bunch of places.
That's amazing to me that you guys ever played at a ground round. But
We played the ground round quite a few times because the ground round actually paid. Because they could actually pay for it. So, you know.
Not bad, actually.
So we played the ground round. It was a weird place to play.
And obviously the rest is history because the Cars go on to be this super group of the 80s. Talking about the story behind a song on, of course, the Cars' debut album, maybe one of your most beloved songs, and that is My Best Friend's Girl.
You're always dancing down the street with the suede blue eyes. Every new boy that you meet, he doesn't know the real surprise.
And I wanted to ask you about it because I'm looking in the new book, Lyrics and Prose, and there it is on page 5, the printed text of My Best Friend's Girl. But on the facing page, there's a photograph of what I gather to be, what is that, the original manuscript of the song?
Oh, yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah. It looks like the original song title was Best Friend's Girl, and someone hand wrote the word in my in front of that.
Yeah, that's true. It must have been me.
So
I guess that my had to be there.
But it wasn't there to begin with?
Oh, I think maybe when I was, you know, once you start singing the song and all that stuff, maybe I was throwing in a my, so I thought I better put the my in there.
She's my best friend's girl.
Well, why don't you tell me the story of you know, the process or the background or what inspired the song?
Well, that's a good question. I could never remember that. That's like 100 years ago. But, you know, songs, when I write songs, I usually write a lot at a time. I could write anywhere from 20 to 30 songs at a time. You know, songs, all the songs are kind of a little autobiographical, although I never. I don't know that any songs I've ever written have been situations that I thought I needed to document because they were sort of historical in my mind or an historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
Although, maybe so. If I leap through, maybe so.
Let the good times roll. Let them knock you around.
So the book, it's not just lyrics, it's called Lyrics and Prose. Do you have the book there in front of you or with you?
I kind of do. Somebody just handed it to me.
Okay, great. Because we're talking about sort of prose. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could read some of the, or one of the prose pieces in the book called Paul's Bakery.
I'm sitting here at Paul's Bakery watching the blizzard and waiting for the studio to open. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows. I'll probably work on the same song for the rest of my life, all songs being one. Hume said that the entire world is in one's mind. All knowledge comes from sensory impression rather than a prior aspect of reality. You don't see time, for instance. So what's the rush? Time is close. Things get quiet when it snows. Time seems to stand still, like when your mind sleeps between thoughts. So let's talk about envy and jealousy and girlfriends and music, misunderstanding, art, money, trips, death, and slime balls. Muscles, cheap talk, friends, videos, leather, business, skin, purpose, rain and bombs, lawyers, notes and sounds, rhythm, drugs, booze, fights, life, environments, pleasure, rumors, images, pressure, guns, style, escape, movement, junkies, losers, motivation, jobs and God and smoke and differences and eyes and the future and illusions and waste traps and focus and feeling and time. It's still snowing outside Paul's Bakery, but I could suck in the smell of this place for a trillion picoseconds. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows.
So that's Rick Ocasek reading his work, Paul's Bakery, from, it appears in the new book, which is kind of more an anthology called Lyrics and Prose. I've heard that you really don't consider yourself to be kind of a front and center entertainer, that rather, right. Like that you're, that's not who you are. So how would you describe what you consider yourself to be?
Tall.
No, actually, I should have expected that. Tall, handsome, dark-haired.
Oh, I don't know about the handsome. I don't get any awards for that. But anyway, I consider myself a writer, a songwriter, for sure. It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I started writing songs, I think. I attempted to write a song when I was 14. I never got to. Once I decided to play music, I immediately thought, well, I don't care if I can play the instrument. I just want to write songs. I've never considered myself a musician, although I can play a lot of things. I'm not a school musician, nor can I read music, but I always wanted to write whole songs and be a songwriter, and I always knew that no matter what band I was ever in, it was going to be a band that played the songs I wrote. You know, and of course, in the early days, you know, they weren't very good songs, but I put a lot of bands through a lot of crap to make them play them until finally, you know, years and years after having a half a dozen bands, finally the songs got good enough.
You ended up being essentially the front man for one of the biggest rock groups of a generation.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how that happened.
Well, Rick Ocasek, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Rick Ocasek, he's the frontman for The Cars. The band was just named one of the newest inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We spoke with him back in 2013. This week we've been ending the show with excerpts from Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the folks here at WBUR and our colleagues at the New York Times. I'm lucky enough to host the podcast. Today's excerpt is a particularly timely and important one, especially in the current moment we all find ourselves in. Me too. Now, those two words have created a flood of emotion over the past months, with millions of women and men using social media to acknowledge sexual abuse or harassment they've personally experienced. So this excerpt of Modern Love, the podcast, comes to us from graduate student Heather Burtman. It's read by Cleopatra Coleman. She reads Heather Burtman's essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You.
When the stranger yelled at me from his car window, I was carrying my Zamioculcus zamioifolia, a large tropical plant I had just bought at a greenhouse. I couldn't hear what he said, but I don't think he was complimenting my plant. His words, whatever they were, brought to mind all of the derogatory comments and crude propositions I had heard before. From different car windows and different men, all of the comments about my body and suggestions for what I could do with it. It was as if once I turned 16, my body no longer belonged to me, but to the world at large, and to certain men who drove their cars past it. When I was a little girl, playing shirtless in my family's garden, my body felt as if it belonged only to me. We had a rectangle-shaped yard out of which we would dig a smaller rectangle, and this dark patch of soil would become our garden. at 5, 6, and 7 years old. My siblings and I laughed as we shook out fat chunks of grass and produced a shower of dirt that went up our noses and down our chests. I liked the way the dirt felt, all freshly dug against my skin, and I asked my mother to bury me in it the way she sometimes did at the beach. She buried me halfway, and I smiled and posed for a picture. I liked being that way. A bare, muddy torso with a handful of seeds that I thought might grow carrots and yield a future in which my body was my body. And your body was your body. During my senior year of high school, I went in for my second bra fitting at JCPenney, where the fitter sniffed a little in disapproval when telling me my cup size, as if she were thinking, "How dare you grow those?" I was now the keeper of this secret. There are sizes beyond double D. You can be an H, for example. That is British sizing. Or a K. That is American sizing. The British make better bras. I was the girl with the big breasts. There were jokes, compliments from female friends, promises that my future boyfriend or husband or lover would have plenty to be happy about. There were men who stared. Men who asked, "Are those real?" I had no answer. I didn't remember consciously deciding about their size or doing anything about it. Around then, I realized that, in this world, there would be many instances when my body would not feel like my body. When I was in a club and a man grabbed my butt and then my hands, trying to pull me in to dance, you can say no 100 times. And he will still pull. There is the knot of your hands and his, and the harder you pull away, the harder he pulls closer. It is like a game to him, like one of those colorful woven tubes that trap your fingers when you exert opposing forces. If you are lucky, your friends will yell at him until he lets go. You will stand there stunned, suddenly realizing how sticky the dance floor is. Also wondering if they have a nice-smelling hand soap in the bathroom. Hand soap that smells like summer air. Being young. Outside. But that is the smell of another world entirely. One that no longer seems to exist. When I walk to work, and men smile at me along the way, they don't have nice smiles anymore. "What's your name?" they say. "Come on, sweetheart, tell me your name." They follow me, their footsteps like trees falling. I can feel it in the air, their need to take something from me. It has nothing to do with me in particular, with me as an individual. It has nothing to do with how I was once a fearless, naked gardener with a blue plastic teapot and a collection of puzzles. If I were to tell them my name, would they remember it? Would they invite me out to a nice dinner and listen as I told them stories about my childhood? Would this be true love? I can picture the scene now. I'm at brunch with my girlfriends at a place that serves bottomless Bloody Marys and slightly overcooked eggs. After round 3, we find ourselves on the usual subject, how we met our significant others. My girlfriends lean in a little closer and say, "Oh, Heather, please tell the story again. Tell us how you and Lyle met." "Well," I begin, taking one last sip of Bloody Mary, "I was walking down the street when Lyle drove by and yelled, 'Hey, baby,' and asked me to have sex with him. And I thought, this one's a keeper." Such behavior is not about me. It's not about love. It's not even about sex. It is about fear and power. What certain men gain from feeding on such things, I do not know. And I do not want to know. While traveling in France one year, I held onto my friend's arm as a man followed us for maybe half a mile, yelling something I didn't understand. There was the glittering river, the stone bridge, the creperie closed for the night. Only the fear really existed. "We can take him," I whispered to her. "I mean, if anything happens." We marched forward, eyeing the distance between the hunted and the hunter. I was too scared to think, and uncertain of how one even got a hold of the police out there. In Connecticut one day, a man drove past me only to turn around and come back. "Oh my God," I thought. "He came back." I felt the fear descending upon me the way a colorful parachute does in a childhood game of cat and mouse. He talked. He laughed. He watched me try not to blink. I always blinked. What is the verb? To savor. To luxuriate in torturing another. Sadism. If someone does this to you, do not give in to the temptation to smile. I tell myself to be the strong woman my mother taught me to be and not smile, but I almost always do. One man said to me, "Do you know who I am? I'm Don Juan, and I'm the best lover in the world. See for yourself." And I thought, good for you, sir, good for you. I smiled at him, laughed even. Another man on another day stood on the sidewalk in front of me as dusk was falling. He was with his friends, and he reached out his arms and pulled me toward him. And what did I do? "I've got to go," I said. "I've got to go," sweet smile. "Walk, don't run. They smell fear, they chase." I will never be six again. I no longer remember what it is like to bask shirtless with a garden against my skin, or for someone to take a picture of my naked torso that they will actually develop at Walgreens. I am 24. And my body makes life dangerous for me. My breasts, my hips, the way I walk. Any woman's breasts, any woman's hips, the way any woman walks. It's all somehow too tempting. Our full lips or thin lips, our necks exposed beneath cropped hair, or our long hair, or the split ends we pick at while sitting on the bus, our pierced or unpierced ears, the infinite circle of belly button winking beneath our shirts. We look too good in our t-shirts and jeans. We look too good bundled up in our coats, carrying houseplants down the street. When we walk home to our apartments late at night, we carry our keys spread out between our fingers and we jump at the shadows of shadows. In the daylight, we pretend we were never afraid. A couple of years ago, in the warmth of summer, I stood naked on a dock, and my buddy was my buddy. My two girlfriends were standing naked beside me, and their bodies were their bodies. Our breasts were our breasts. Our clothes were our clothes that we had chosen to wear and chosen to take off, leaving them in warm heaps on the chilled wood next to the damp footprints which were also ours. When we jumped into the water, we chose to jump in. The weeds brushed against our bodies obliviously, encircling our fingers and toes and hips with no knowledge of or care about which was which. We splashed water with our fists and yelled, but if we were afraid, it was only a fish. That thought made us laugh. We saluted the dark, starry, silent sky, and it did not so much as whistle back.
Cleopatra Coleman, reading Heather Burtman's modern love essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You. Now, as part of Modern Love, the podcast, we often ask actors why they picked certain essays to read for us. And Coleman said that Burtman's essay brought up a lot of memories for her.
It articulates something that I think, just speaking for myself, have felt and experienced my entire life. But I had a really innocent childhood, lots of naked running around in mud and, like, you know, very much like this essay. At a certain point, it just changes. And as a woman, you just get so used to it. Like, everywhere you go, like, God forbid if I walk past a group of men and then I have to turn around for some reason, I will watch them all look away immediately because they've all been looking or pointing or talking. And so I find this incredibly satisfying and really beautiful.
That's Cleopatra Coleman. You can see her in Fox's The Last Man on Earth and Showtime's White Famous. I hope you enjoyed this sample of Modern Love, the podcast. And if you did, think about subscribing. And by the way, don't forget the show that brought you this little sample, because Radio Boston has a podcast as well. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.